now. Detonate the reality bomb!
Jesus Christ, for America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
Pentagon spends a lot of money researching ways to enhance soldiers' performance on the battlefield, to heal soldiers, but also looking for tools that may, beyond the military applications, battlefield applications, fundamentally change what it means to be human. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest is an investigative journalist and New York Times bestselling author. Her previous books, Fascinating Topics, Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Military Base, Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America, and both of those being developed for television by some pretty high-powered teams. It is our honor, the new book should give you the title there, The Pentagon's Brain, An Uncensored History of DARPA, America's Top Secret Military Research Agency. And we welcome Annie Jacobson to the program. Annie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
DARPA, after covering Area 51 and Operation Paperclip, how did that prepare you, or what was the link that led you to then look into the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency?
Well, in some ways, they really work as a trilogy. Specifically, I was looking, when I was writing Operation Paperclip, my last book about the Nazi scientists, I was looking specifically into what Wernher von Braun was doing in the late 50s. And I was surprised to learn that he was up for this position of chief scientist at this new agency inside the Pentagon that was then called ARPA. We know about it now as ARPA. As DARPA. And von Braun, of course, being as ambitious as he was, he said he was interested in taking this job, but he wanted to bring 12 of his fellow Nazis from Huntsville with him to the Pentagon.
Oh.
And that was kind of a dividing line in the sand, I think, for Department of Defense. And they said no. And so there became another chief scientist. His name was Herb York. But I thought, what an amazing way to start an agency, you know, a secret agency, an agency that most people have never heard of, with such controversy and mystery attached to it. And then, of course, researching DARPA, there was even so much more to be revealed.
Hmm. There's, in the conspiratorial vein in which I sometimes travel, my wife and I wear foil hats on the weekend so our friends don't have to. There are sometimes some really outrageous claims that make it to the internet. I'm sure you've seen this, various websites, people who type in all capital letters with multiple exclamation points, making claims about things coming out of DARPA that are really, you know, almost too crazy to believe. How strange, when you started digging into the history of DARPA, how strange were some of the things that DARPA actually is involved with?
Well, I'll tell you those, but let me give you a little background thought. I, too, I don't wear a tinfoil hat on the weekend, but I certainly have many friends and colleagues who do. And many of my book signings are half filled with, you know, nuclear scientists and half filled with conspiracy theorists. And, you know, I talk to both sides. I did a big room full of people, an auditorium full of people at Caltech. Half of them were JPL scientists and the other half was obsessed with UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I think is important is people being engaged and interested, and then it makes them interesting. And so I often say about the conspiracy theorists, and I put that in quotes, is that many of my books overlap into that realm. It's just that 50% of it is fact, and then often 50% or maybe 10% is speculation, and that's where you get into the idea of conspiracy theory, because maybe the speculation is not yet able to be backed up. Maybe it will never be backed up. But I give a lot of credit to people who, you know, think hard about where things might be headed. And that is certainly the case of the book. I mean, you know, DARPA is this incredible agency. It's the most productive, most powerful military science agency in the world. And yet, It's one of the least reported on. Mm-hmm. You asked me spooky. When I got to the end of the book and I started seeing some of the programs that you referred to earlier that deal with transhumanism, this idea of augmenting the warfighter's physiology and cognition, so the body and the mind, with machines and other means, then you start really getting into some areas, I think, that is worth pausing and investigating.
Mm-hmm. And I'll mention again that we're working with Skywatch TV, which is a Christian ministry that's in the process of producing a film on the transhumanist movement. And so, of course, some of what DARPA has been involved in has come across our radar in the course of researching and writing the film. But again, we want to keep it, you know, based on evidence that can be documented. We don't want to jump to conclusions and lead people astray. We want to base the conclusions that we reach on hard evidence. Personally speaking, I don't have a problem with our government doing everything that it can in order to protect us and keep us safe. So in concept, I don't have a problem with researching ways of protecting our soldiers, helping them to heal more effectively, not just from physical trauma, but mental trauma as well, emotional trauma. But when we start getting into the idea of transforming humans into something other, I begin to think now, okay, wait a minute here. We're crossing a line in redefining what it means to be human so that we can more efficiently kill other humans. Is that a groundless fear? How far is DARPA going in that direction?
No, that is actually an accurate assessment. And so to begin with, DARPA has been publicly making this movement by coupling animals and machines, okay, with the longer-term idea mm-hmm. of coupling humans and machines, which is already happening as well. We'll get into that in a moment. But the history takes us back to coupling animal and machine. And in science fiction, that used to be called cyborgs. DARPA calls them biohybrids. Mm. And when you look at how old these programs are, it's fascinating. At the turn of this century, right around the year 2000, DARPA succeeded in creating its first cyborg rat. It was called Robo-Rat. And by putting an electrode in the rat's brain and then wiring it through these like sort of hair-sized wires that were then sewn into the rat's back, DARPA scientists were able to control this rat remotely, wirelessly, and move it through a maze. I mean, an incredible metaphor there, like taking the cyborg into the labyrinth mm-hmm. and dominating and having the ability to control an animal. And DARPA has also recently done that again with a moth. And so this is even really more profound when you think about it, when you think about controlling flight. The DARPA scientists inserted electrodes behind the neck of what's called a Mandica sexta moth. When the moth was in its pupa stage, so when it was still a worm. And then the insect metamorphosized, the wings came out, and now that electrode is part of the body. And DARPA scientists were able to steer, to remotely control that moth in flight. Hmm. The moth has a 90-day life cycle, so it was a short period of control before its death. But this is really groundbreaking when you think about the idea that DARPA is moving toward neuroprosthetics. That's what they call them. You might call it a brain chip. And they've been involved in clinical trials of putting electrodes into the brains, the soft tissue of the brain, of war-wounded veterans. And then you really have to ask, where is this going?
Mm-hmm. Now, have they done this? They have actually implanted chips into wounded soldiers?
In clinical trials.
In clinical trials.
In partnership with the National Institute of Health.
Okay.
And the idea behind these programs, they fall under a rubric called RAM, Restoring Active Memory. So the idea behind it is of the 2.5 million soldiers who went to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, 300,000 of them came back with the brain injuries. I mean, an astonishing number because of all the IEDs there.
Oh, concussion.
So you have, yes. And so you have these soldiers that are being looked at to have these brain implants so that they can restore cognitive functioning. That is the big long-term plan, and that's certainly the White House has teamed up with DARPA, which really begs another question, but the White House has a program called the Brain Initiative.
Yes.
And so these are all presented as these great beneficent programs to help people restore their memory. But the scientists that I interviewed, including the Jason scientists, who've been advising the Pentagon, advising DARPA going back to 1960, the Jason scientists specifically warned against these kind of brain chip programs, and they said, and I quote, this could lead to high-quality brain control.
High-quality brain control. Mind control.
Mind control. That's the Jason scientists, who, by the way, the conspiracy theorists go crazy about, you know, have them right up there with the Illuminati as sort of these wicked, wicked idea scientists. But I found the Jason scientists to be quite the opposite from interviewing them and reading many of these declassified reports that they've written. They're actually very level-headed scientists, a lot of whom are great physicists at universities across America. But again, the Jason scientists recently told DARPA, told the Pentagon, this is not a good idea to begin moving toward putting neuroprosthetics into the minds of soldiers.
And in fact, my wife and I produce a weekly program, a video program on Fridays that we call Sci Friday, which is not coincidentally a kind of a nod towards science fiction, because some of what's coming down the pike now in terms of research would have been considered science fiction not very long ago. And we did mention, in fact, some of this research. You know, Sharon's degree is in molecular biology with a genetics emphasis, a degree with honors. And she raised, I thought, a very good question. If this is, these neuroprosthetics are intended to restore cognitive function and perhaps restore memory, could it in fact work the other way and suppress memories? In other words, help soldiers heal from traumatic experiences by making them forget things that they saw. Is that part of the research?
Well, that's actually a different program from my understanding, and that's called subnets. And that involves what is called deep, it also involves these electrodes in the brain, but it's called deep brain stimulation. So it goes into a different part of the brain, whereas the RAM and Remind and Repair programs, those are the acronyms for them, they place the electrodes or the brain chips in an area that deals with memory.
Okay.
And so the PTSD programs, the subnets programs, that is deep brain stimulation in another part of the brain that is affected by trauma. And the way one scientist described it to me was that it's kind of like an electroshock therapy on the go. The soldiers have these implants, and then some researchers at the university who are watching them remotely are monitoring brain signals, perhaps of things like depression. This would be the ideal down the road. And then give them essentially a jolt, that electroshock therapy on the go.
That's the big thing. These implants then are remotely, and they are communicating in two directions.
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh.
And so that's, but again, that's where the obvious point from the Jason scientists is very clear.
Yes.
That this is, if you're able to administer a shock to a soldier in the field, to, you know, a veteran, to help him with, you know, PTSD, you are assuming a kind of control of that individual that raises very serious consent issues, ethical issues. I mean, one of the problems I had with the veterans who are coming back with cognitive impairment is where is that idea of consent coming into play? My understanding is some of the tests were being done on soldiers that were in a deep vegetative state. So it's pretty clear that obviously their families would grant consent in that regard.
But I hope so.
If you have someone who's struggling with, you know, making decisions, how are they able to make this decision? It's a very fine line, and DARPA would not give me access to any of the individuals involved in the clinical trials, nor would they allow me to interview the neuroscientists who are working on these programs. I interviewed 75 scientists affiliated with DARPA, but none who are working on these current brain programs were authorized to speak to me.
The book is The Pentagon's Brain. Annie Jacobson is the author. backing up a step, you mentioned the White House has some interest in it. Of course, the BRAIN initiative that was announced by the president several years ago has also been on our radar. What is the White House interest in this research?
Well, that's the question that I asked. I mean, particularly lining up with DARPA struck me as a little bit odd because, first of all, it's very important to remember that DARPA's mission is to create, and I'm going to quote here, vast weapon systems of the future. That is what Secretary of Defense McElroy told Congress in 1958 when DARPA's charter went into effect, and that continues to be their mission. So their press office, you could call it their advertising office, they have a very different, you know, presentation about what DARPA is and what DARPA does, often with these kind of great, look what we're doing for society, we're sending robots into Fukushima type idea. Mm-hmm. But one must never forget that the purpose is to create weapon systems.
Yeah.
And so when I learned that the White House is teaming up with DARPA on the BRAIN initiative, it gets even more complicated because, you know, helping wounded veterans is the VA's job. And so why is DARPA taking lead position on these BRAIN programs if not for leading toward technology that is informing a vast weapon system of the future,
mm-hmm.
which I am very clear is artificial intelligence. I mean, that is the plan that DARPA has separately, and the question that I raise in the book, you know, the Pentagon has a plan in place, absolutely readable and fact-checkable, for what they call rapid acceleration of development of artificially intelligent weapon systems.
Hmm.
And so the question that I raise in the book is, are these BRAIN programs, in essence, a way for DARPA to explore the missing link? You know, artificial intelligence has been long sought for decades now, and no one has broken that barrier. So the question is, will these BRAIN programs give neuroscientists access to a system of system that allows machines to think?
And that is the key. I've had the opportunity to interview Dr. Hugo de Garis a couple of times, who was a leading researcher into artificial intelligence. He worked as the head of the BRAIN initiative at the Xiamen University in China. And he admitted to me, you know, off the record, that essentially when they're trying to program these neural networks, they put input into a black box, basically, and stuff comes out the other side. And if the result isn't what they want, they change the input and tweak it until they get the results that they want. But what goes on inside the black box, they really don't know. And, of course, that black box is what they're trying to inside the black box is where they're trying to replicate the human brain. But they don't even know what's going on inside the black box, much less what's going on inside the human head. So it makes sense that research being done by DARPA might unlock that black box, in a manner of speaking.
Yes, I mean, any neuroscientist will tell you that the human brain does things beyond anyone's comprehension.
Right.
I mean, you know, evolution has created the smartest brain and the smartest machine in the world, is what one of the DARPA scientists working on creating a synthetic brain at Los Alamos Nuclear Laboratory told me. You know, there are 100 billion neurons in the brain's gray matter. This is like an astonishing mystery to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is DARPA looking at using supercomputers to map the activity of those 100 billion neurons to break that barrier to artificial intelligence? And if so, then what?
Yeah, then what? Because and there was an article I read about your book last week, and the question, and I don't know if they were quoting you or if it was the opinion of the reviewer, but it seems like the big question that must be kept in mind whenever we look at anything DARPA does is, how can this be weaponized?
Well, that is absolutely what the plan is. And again, this is separate from that, is that DARPA's rapid acceleration plans for armies of drones is in play. So, you know, people know about the Predator drone that flies, but there are drones that are the size of my finger that crawl. There are drones that run. There are human-sized drones that walk. There's a rhinoceros-sized drone that carries of operators back, you know, heavy gear into the battlefield. That drone is called the L3. If it is knocked over, it uses laser technology to, you know, right itself back up by figuring out where to put its legs on the terrain so it can get back up. I mean, the technology is so advanced. These are all drones that are moving toward being able to be autonomous drones. And when I say autonomous, I mean having governance built into them,
mm-hmm.
being able to make decisions, machines making decisions on their own with no operator in the loop.
The so-called Terminator scenario.
Yes, and this is what the Pentagon has in play as Pentagon dogma moving forward to 2038.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the plans. It's called role of autonomy in DOD systems.
Given the change in demographics, I can understand why that's happening. The population is aging, not just here, but across most of the world, especially the Northern Hemisphere, where men and women of military age are aging out of the range in which you'd want to send people into battle. But that's a topic for another program. I want to talk
but
more.
I would like to make this point, which is that I do disagree, because I don't think it has anything to do with age or with human or with physiology. I think it has to do with defense contractors.
When you look at the
people who are pushing the movement toward machine technology, who are pushing the movement toward full robotic warfare, those are the very individuals who are on the boards of the defense contractors.
Mm.
I write about this in the book, and I think it's a very important note to consider, because this is the worst side of the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned us about, where it's a closed loop, where the defense contractors are, in essence, creating the system that will fight wars, and therefore creating the wars themselves.
Mm. That's a really good point, and I should have considered that. I was looking at it just from a strategic standpoint, military planners looking at our global reach and wondering how to maintain it with a population that is aging. And there are some who suggest that that has something to do with our immigration policies in recent years. But again, I suppose that aspect would be for another program. But you're right. And as we study history and we look back 2,000 years, we can see that the Roman Empire senators were pushing for war against, say, Pergamum or against Parthia, because they had certain concessions in, say, the spice trade, and they needed to open up new supplies, new cheap supplies, or new markets for goods to which they held the contracts. It's the same thing today. One of the things that really shocked me about 7 or 8 years ago was reading the book The Spy Who Billed Me by R.J. Hillhouse, in which she pointed out that by, I think, reverse engineering a PowerPoint file that had been left on an unsecured server at the DOD, that something like 65% or 70% of America's intelligence budget was going to private contractors. And some of those contractors also make weapon systems, which you think might just have an impact on the way they interpret intelligence.
Well, absolutely. That's that closed loop, again, that Eisenhower mm-hmm. warned about. I mean, he did give us hope, however. In that famous speech, he says, you know, America must have a strong military, and therefore the military-industrial complex can live side by side with a peaceful democracy. But it's dependent upon the alert and knowledgeable citizen. And that is, I think, the bigger point.
Yes.
And it's why I write my books and why you do what you do, because being alert and knowledgeable goes a lot farther than most people give it credit for. Everyone thinks they need to somehow be an activist or a congressman to affect change. And I disagree wholeheartedly. I think being alert and aware, you intuitively make decisions and have conversations.
You know, that raises another question, this closed loop that you describe. A few years ago, a colleague at work was telling me about a friend of hers who was a senior engineering student at a Midwestern university, and as part of an engineering challenge was developing a dragonfly-sized drone. And there have been some reports of drones like that, you know, showing up at protests and so forth in recent years. But what struck me was that this was going on as part of classwork at a Midwestern university where groups of engineering students were getting together to work on things like this. How far does DARPA reach into our educational systems to try to draw on some of the best and brightest coming up through college right now?
Well, that's a great question, and I will say they dig very deep in. Some people call it the military-industrial academic complex, but there's also an important side of this. I mean, at any given time in its history, DARPA has roughly 120 program managers. This year's budget for DARPA is $3 billion, and that's about what it is adjusted for inflation over the decades. So think about that. Divide 120 program managers by $3 billion. You can see how much money, power, and flexibility those individual program managers have. They then reach into academic laboratories, military laboratories, and industry, and they build their programs that way. So there's an enormous amount of money to be had, and many of the academic professors who are working on DARPA contracts while teaching are super grateful for this opportunity because, as they told me in interviews, DARPA will fund research, what is called blue sky research, that no one else will fund.
No, I was going to ask, just to backtrack a little bit, the history of DARPA itself, what was it that prompted the United States government to create ARPA and then DARPA, and how has its mission or its operation changed since 1958?
So I begin the book actually 4 years before DARPA was founded in 1954 at this unbelievably enormous thermonuclear bomb test called Castle Bravo. It was the largest bomb in the world at the time, 15 megatons. And the reason I start with that is because the very scientists who created this bomb believed that it should not be built. Two of them called it an evil thing in a letter to the president. And yet it was built anyways, and I begin the moment that this bomb goes off, told from the perspective of two eyewitnesses who were there, who were engineers. And this was a weapon against which there is no defense. There still is no defense against a thermonuclear weapon. We rely on a political situation called MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction, which is in essence that everybody is, you know, no one is crazy enough to push the button.
Right.
But, you know, there's this idea that humans are the ones that have to push the button. And humans have, at least since the early 1950s, been sane enough not to push the button. And so DARPA was created specifically in 1958, just a few weeks after the Russians launched Sputnik. So Sputnik was that 23-inch sphere that was the first space satellite circling the Earth every 93 minutes. In and of itself, what's so menacing about that? Well, the menace came from the ICBM, the long-range missile at the time, that lofted that satellite into space. The idea being that very soon a thermonuclear warhead could be put on the nose cone of a long-range missile and could land on Washington. Within a matter of weeks, DARPA was created.
Now, when it was tasked with what? I mean, what was the original, you know, orders given to the head of DARPA?
Well, DARPA was in charge of everything in space. It was called ARPA at the time, but they were in charge of everything in space. So it was NASA before NASA existed. NASA came into existence later that year. And it was really in charge of ballistic missile defense. And then when treaties were signed that, you know, prohibited nuclear testing in the atmosphere, it was in charge of detecting nuclear tests in case anyone was cheating. So that's why DARPA became incredibly involved in satellite technology, which has now become GPS technology, sensor technology. DARPA was off and running. But as I write in the book, it experienced a sea change, or rather a sea shift, when Vietnam came into play. And then suddenly DARPA was in, you know, every kind of weapon system possible, because we were trying to create these you know, conventional weapons and high technology, new weapons that could be used on the ground to fight this war against the insurgents. And it just splintered off DARPA in many different directions, which all have an incredible legacy that take us through today, which is what I found so fascinating writing this book, was looking at these old seeds, you know, whether it was drones or sensor technology or stealth. These were all born of the in the jungles in Vietnam.
Hmm. One of the bits of research recently that caught our attention, and again, it's because my wife has her eye out for stories that relate to genetics research, was the story last week that DARPA has invested a fair sum of money with MIT into DNA manufacturing, which raises some interesting questions. What was the most interesting or maybe disturbing bit of research that you uncovered in researching the Pentagon's brain?
Well, it has to do with storytelling, with narratives, and with trust. And maybe that's just because it's close to my heart, because as a journalist, it's my job to inform the public. But I'm also aware of the fact of the power of narratives, you know, the power of storytelling. I choose certain stories to tell readers to lay out my book, and others of them get excluded. And so while one hopes to, you know, tell a balanced story, as an author, you're really in charge of the storytelling. So this really caught my eye when I saw that DARPA had a program having to do with narrative networks. It immediately made me think what kind of propaganda is going on there.
Yeah.
And yes, there was stuff that was disturbing. It was like trying to get all these social scientists to, you know, rewrite some kind of bogus narrative about Afghanistan and what a success it was. This was, you know, in 2012, 2013 when I was researching the book, and I thought, well, that's not going to fly. And, you know, no amount of narrative propaganda is going to make anyone think anything other than, you know, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan were disasters as a result. Whatever you think of why we went there, how it was when we were there, the truth of the matter now, looking at them from the perspective of today, is a disaster. You know, the Taliban just took a town in an entire city in Afghanistan for the first time in 13 years.
Right,
so
absolutely.
I thought, well, this seems like a futile effort if DARPA is trying to do some kind of bogus storytelling. No one's going to buy it. But then I came across another program within that same umbrella of program. It's called Narrative Networks. And it involved trust. And here's what I found spooky about it, okay? So in the trust program, DARPA is trying to develop techniques to quantify the effect of narrative on the human mind, on human cognition, okay? And the way they're doing it is looking at brain chemicals. And this, again, where it gets into an area where I sense the possibilities of manipulation. And I interviewed the doctor who is in charge of this program here at UC Claremont, who found what he calls the brain's moral molecule. And this is a chemical in the brain called oxytocin. And what, to just to give you an idea of what oxytocin is, when mothers breastfeed children, newborn babies, they emit oxytocin.
Oh.
So you can imagine nothing more pure and moral and trust building than that mother and child breastfeeding relationship, okay? So now DARPA has its hands on oxytocin, and it has the doctor who discovered the moral molecule working on programs for it. And, you know, the doctor involved seems to think it's all well and great, and that the Pentagon and DARPA are suddenly interested in making people trust one another. But again, that's the job of the State Department. That's not the job of the agency that's responsible for vast weapon systems of the future. So then you have to ask, well, what is DARPA doing with oxytocin?
Exactly.
And I'll give you this for a final example. There are researchers at the University of Bonn in Germany. So this is, you know, a very objective third party here. And last December, they did a clinical trial where they squirted oxytocin into the noses of 64 men to see, are you ready for this? To see if they could erase fear. And the lead researcher, Monica Eckstein, told Scientific American, that's exactly what they did.
Wow.
So when we have a government entity that's working with a chemical in the brain that's capable of artificially erasing fear, that concerns me to the point of spookiness.
Mm. Absolutely. The book Pentagon, The Pentagon's Brain, now available. Annie's website, AnnieJacobson.com. I presume the book is available at all the typical outlets online and brick-and-mortar stores? And one quick question, because I know your time is short. Both Area 51 and Operation Paperclip are being developed for television. Area 51 in particular, Gail Ann Hurd and Chris Carter, that's a high-powered team. How quickly are we going to see any this come to television?
Well, you know, it's a slow go, I must say. But also what is very exciting is Brad Pitt's company is
yes.
doing Operation Paperclip. And when you think about the kind of, you know, they brought us, his Plan B is the name of the company, they brought us 12 Years a Slave, an amazing movie that really opens up the public's eye into stories that are not well known and that should be known. So I'm really looking forward, I always look forward to having my stories told in a different venue, and because, of course, they're not really my stories. My stories are the stories that I have put together because they've been so generously told to me by so many of these scientists, engineers, soldiers, and spies who lived through these experiences and whose stories are really a great part of American history.
Hmm. Yeah, and not known well enough by those of us who have placed our trust in the government behind these programs. Annie Jacobson is the
author.
That's
the double-edged sword that's always important to keep in mind, that, you know, we have an incredibly strong national security, and there's really a lot to be grateful for and to acknowledge about that. I mean, when you think of the way in which so many people around the world live in insecurity, and we have this incredibly secure land, and DARPA is partially responsible for that, and they do an amazing job making sure that we are not overtaken by technological surprise. The checks and balances comes into play, that alert and knowledgeable citizenry we've been talking about,
mm-hmm.
when we're thinking of the future and which direction we're going to go, and making sure that those decisions are democratic and that those are good for a large number of people, not just the defense contractors who are building those robotic systems.
Mm. Annie, and we thank you for your work and research in bringing those stories to light and helping us to be better informed about these programs. The book is The Pentagon's Brain, An Uncensored History of DARPA, America's Top Secret Military Research Agency. Annie Jacobson, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
For a link to Annie Jacobson's website where you can find a copy of The Pentagon's Brain, log on to vftb.net. That is, as we say, an acronym, vftbviewfromthebunker.net. And just bought a copy of the book and beginning to read it on Kindle. Look forward to digging into it and finding out what she uncovered, some more of the specifics of what she uncovered in her research into DARPA. Dr. Michael Heiser was here in the Ozarks earlier this week. He's read both of her previous books, The History of Area 51 and the Chronicle of Operation Paperclip, which, of course, brought the Nazi scientists over to the United States after World War II. On the QT, of course, because the American public would not have been very sympathetic to offering safe haven and a well-paid job to the scientists responsible for some of the horrors that were becoming known during World War II. Because there were just far too many Americans during World War II who knew somebody or either personally or through an extended family or through friends and colleagues who'd lost their life or been seriously injured trying to take down the Nazi regime. And suddenly, you know, we've got hundreds, thousands, perhaps, of these scientists smuggled into the country to help us in the war against communism. So anyway, Mike recommends those two books. I've read the Operation Paperclip book, and I will second his recommendation there. So if this book on the history of DARPA is as good as the previous two, it'll be a valuable addition to the reference library here. And looking forward to the television series based on her books about the Operation Paperclip being developed by Brad Pitt's production company and Area 51 being developed by Chris Carter of X-Files fame, which is not a surprise, I suppose, and Gail Ann Hurd, a very high-powered, very successful Hollywood producer with some really big credits on her resume. So that should be really interesting. Interestingly, also this week, we see in the news from a couple of sources, Dr. Raymond Kurzweil being quoted as saying that he expects us to be directly connected, well, wirelessly connected to the internet in the very near future through nanotechnology implants that will directly interface with our neocortex, the brain's neocortex, and have a Wi-Fi connection, apparently, to the internet, which he thinks will give us godlike abilities, extreme intelligence. And he thinks this is a good thing, would add additional levels of abstraction to our thought and allow us to more profoundly express ourselves musically. It will be funnier, he thinks. We're going to be sexier, better at expressing more loving sentiments. And this is very similar. His attitude here, in my view, is very, frankly, naive. And unlike the Christian faith, which is based on historical evidence and eyewitness testimony, Dr. Kurzweil and those like him in the transhumanist movement, the true believers, are basing their faith on the exact opposite of what we observe in the human condition. Their faith is not based, frankly, on reality. There is no reason to believe, and there are critics out there who are warning about this, but there's no reason to believe that being massively and supremely more intelligent will make us more loving and funnier and more tolerant of our fellow men and women. If anything else, I mean, why wouldn't the evil, the bad side of humanity also likewise be amplified? Make us super evil, super selfish, intensely cruel. Wouldn't it magnify the worst aspects of humanity? I don't see any reason why it wouldn't. And I don't hear any good reason, any good proposal for preventing it from the transhumanist movement. It is startling. When I was a freshman in college, we took a course called Freshman Preceptorial, liberal arts college, emphasis on liberal, where we would take a different book, a book that espoused a different worldview each week. We would read it, discuss it, study it, and at the end of the 10-week term, we would write a paper on which one we thought best captured the human condition. And among the works that we read, I think I based my final paper on a book by Sigmund Freud, because of the line in his book, Man is a Wolf to Man, which I thought was observably true when you look at human history. One thing we've consistently gotten better at as humans is not, you know, humor or sexiness or, loving expression. It's at killing each other. The 20th century was the deadliest, the bloodiest in human history. So when I looked at the Communist Manifesto, read the Communist Manifesto, which was one of the books that we read, surprise, during this 10-week trimester, I thought that Marx and Engels, to give them credit, accurately identified problems with the capitalist system, but they didn't identify the cause. They were identifying symptoms, but not the cause. And I think if we're honest today here in the United States, where we have got sort of a free market system, except the government now has its fingers in just about everything. But this is as close as human history has had to a true free market capitalist system. We can see that the gap between the CEO class and the starting wage earner has the gap between the average incomes of those two types of people has grown almost exponentially over the last generation or so. Your typical CEO has an income that is a multiplier greater than what the starting mailroom guy earns, and that multiplier has increased substantially over the last 40 or 50 years. So it's tempting for some to point at capitalism as being the problem and say, you know, if we just had a socialist system where everything was state-owned and controlled and doled out so that nobody had too much and everybody had it at least enough and nobody had too much, things would be a lot better. And I suppose under an ideal world where there was no sin, that might work. But in that ideal world, capitalism would also work. See, the problem is not the system. The problem are the people. Is the people in it. Jesus said, "The poor you will always have with you." I remember hearing that in church when I was a kid, and I thought, "Wow, Jesus was really a pessimist." No, Jesus just knew the condition of the human heart. The reason we will always have poor with us is because there will always be those who want to take advantage of other people. There are some people who have no qualms about doing whatever it takes to get what they want at the expense of other people. That's true under capitalism. That's true under socialism, communism, communitarianism, totalitarian, whatever. And the same will be true in a transhumanist society. Radically enhance human intelligence, you will also radically enhance the human capacity for evil. And it is stunning to think that somebody as intelligent as Dr. Raymond Kurzweil, who is generally recognized as one of the most brilliant inventors of the last 100 years, doesn't see that. It is astonishing. And he's not the only one. There are a lot of very intelligent people in that movement who are just convinced that technology is an unqualified good. And sadly, there are those in the Christian community who are beginning to buy into that. I see that Reverend Dr. Christopher Benick, who was a fairly recent guest here on A View from the Bunker, has published another essay. Christian Post has picked it up, and he's kind of doubled down on a statement that he made that I had to ask him about. In fact, we first got in contact because I was critical of him during a comment on Skywatch TV, where he mentioned that technology, or he wrote that technology might allow us to participate in God's redemptive process for humanity. And redemptive process to me sounds like salvation, and I said so, and then added, that's above our pay grade. The redemptive process was Christ's work on the cross. And when he said, it is finished, it was finished. We don't participate in that. Well, when we interviewed, he seemed to back away from that a little bit, or allowed as how maybe I misunderstood what he was saying, which was that we can use technology to enhance the quality of life for those who are poor, downtrodden, needy. And he's right about that. He's absolutely right about that. But in his most recent column, he's gone further and said that the technology, the transhumanist movement, may allow us the technology to essentially achieve some of our eschatological goals. And to me, again, that's drawing a little too close toward ye shall be as gods, you know, apotheosis or immanentizing the eschaton. We will somehow bring on the end of days by enhancing what it means to be human through technology. And I reject that. That's not what it means to be created in God's image. It's a misunderstanding of what that passage in Genesis means. And certainly any attempt for us, by us, to achieve it on our own is, by definition, Luciferian. Because there's nothing we can do. Well, that's interesting. Test of the fire alarm going on here at the Skywatch TV studios. Either that or I've crossed some sort of line. Well, coming up on A View from the Bunker, I guess that's the limit. You've talked too long, Derek. Shut up. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, we'll talk about the technocracy movement and what role the Vatican is playing in it, how President Obama is facilitating it through the approval this week of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They've negotiated the deal. Now they've got to get it through Congress. But if he's got fast-track capability, which I believe he does, I'm going to talk with Patrick Wood about that this afternoon. I kind of lost track of it there for a bit, so I'm not sure exactly where the status is, but I don't have any doubt that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is going to become a reality, a trade deal between the U.S. and 11 Asian Pacific nations. It's being sold to us as a way to curb the growing strength of China, but in actuality, it is a step forward for the transhumanist, or rather the technocratic movement, of which transhumanism just plays a small part. So that will be coming up Sunday on A View from the Bunker, which is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. Remember, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.